clangorous screech of iron on stone. An attendant hauled open the doors leading off the platform, and instantly the noise redoubled and the heat swept over them like a breaking wave. A blaze of scorching light made them shade their eyes. Only Zaphania seemed unaffected by the onslaught of sound and light and heat. When her senses had adjusted, Mrs. Coulter looked around, alive with curiosity. She had seen forges, ironworks, manufactories in her own world. The biggest seemed like a village smithy beside this. Hammers the size of houses were lifted in a moment to the distant ceiling and then hurled downward to flatten balks of iron the size of tree trunks, pounding them flat in a fraction of a second with a blow that made the very mountain tremble. From a vent in the rocky wall, a river of sulphurous molten metal flowed until it was cut off by an adamant gate, and the brilliant seething flood rushed through channels and sluices and over weirs into row upon row of moulds to settle and cool in a cloud of evil smoke. Gigantic slicing machines and rollers cut and folded and pressed sheets of inch-thick iron as if it were tissue paper, and then those monstrous hammers pounded it flat again, layering metal upon metal with such force that the different layers became one tougher one, over and over again. If Yorick Birnison could have seen this armory, he might have admitted that these people knew something about working with metal. Mrs. Coulter could only look and wonder. It was impossible to speak and be understood, and no one tried. And now Lord Asriel was gesturing to the small group to follow him along a grated walkway suspended over an even larger vault below, where miners toiled with picks and spades to hack the bright metals from the mother rock. They passed over the walkway and down a long rocky corridor, where stalactites hung gleaming with strange colours and where the pounding and grinding and hammering gradually faded. Mrs. Coulter could feel a cool breeze on her heated face. The crystals that gave them light were neither mounted on sconces nor enclosed in glowing pillars, but scattered loosely on the floor, and there were no flaring torches to add to the heat. So little by little the party began to feel cold again, and presently they came out quite suddenly into the night air. They were at a place where part of the mountain had been hacked away, making a space as wide and open as a parade ground. Further along they could see, dimly lit, great iron doors in the mountainside, some open and some shut, and from out of one of the mighty doorways men were hauling something draped in a tarpaulin.
"What is that?"
Mrs. Coulter said to the African king.
"The intention craft."
Mrs. Coulter had no idea what that could mean, and watched with intense curiosity as they prepared to take off the tarpaulin. She stood close to King Ogunwe, as if for shelter, and said,
"How does it work? What does it do?"
"We're about to see."
It looked like some kind of complex drilling apparatus, or the cockpit of a gyropter, or the cabin of a massive crane. It had a glass canopy over a seat, with at least a dozen levers and handles banked in front of it. It stood on six legs, each jointed and sprung at a different angle to the body, so that it seemed both energetic and ungainly. And the body itself was a mass of pipework, cylinders, pistons, coiled cables, switchgear, valves, and gauges. It was hard to tell what was structure and what was not, because it was only lit from behind, and most of it was hidden in gloom. Lord Roke on his hawk had glided up to it directly, circling above, examining it from all sides. Lord Asriel and the Angel were close in discussion with the engineers, and men were clambering down from the craft itself, one carrying a clipboard, another a length of cable. Mrs. Coulter's eyes gazed at the craft hungrily, memorizing every part of it, making sense of its complexity. And as she watched, Lord Asriel swung himself up into the seat, fastening a leather harness around his waist and shoulders, and setting a helmet securely on his head. His demon, the snow leopard, sprang up to follow him, and he turned to adjust something beside her. The engineer called up, Lord Asriel replied, and the men withdrew to the doorway. The intention craft moved, though Mrs. Coulter was not sure how. It was almost as if it had quivered, though there it was, quite still, poised with a strange energy on those six insect legs. As she looked, it moved again, and then she saw what was happening. Various parts of it were revolving, turning this way and that, scanning the dark sky overhead. Lord Asriel sat busily moving this lever, checking that dial, adjusting that control. And then suddenly the intention craft vanished. Somehow it had sprung into the air. It was hovering above them now, as high as a treetop, turning slowly to the left. There was no sound of an engine, no hint of how it was held against gravity. It simply hung in the air.
"Listen, to the south."
She turned her head and strained to hear. There was a wind that moaned around the edge of the mountain, and there were the deep hammer blows from the presses which she felt through the soles of her feet, and there was the sound of voices from the lit doorway. But at some signal the voices stopped and the lights were extinguished. And in the quiet Mrs. Coulter could hear, very faintly, the chop-chop-chop of gyropter engines on the gusts of wind.
"Who are they?"
"Decoys,"
said the king.
"My pilots, flying a mission to tempt the enemy to follow. Watch."
She widened her eyes, trying to see anything against the heavy dark with its few stars. Above them, the intention craft hung as firmly as if it were anchored and bolted there. No gust of wind had the slightest effect on it. No light came from the cockpit, so it was very difficult to see, and the figure of Lord Asriel was out of sight completely. Then she caught the first sight of a group of lights low in the sky, at the same moment as the engine sound became loud enough to hear steadily. 6 gyropters, flying fast, one of them seemingly in trouble, for smoke trailed from it, and it flew lower than the others. They were making for the mountain, but on a course to take them past it and beyond. And behind them, in close pursuit, came a motley collection of flyers. It was not easy to make out what they were, but Mrs. Coulter saw a heavy gyropter of a strange kind, 2 straight-winged aircraft, 1 great bird that glided with effortless speed carrying 2 armed riders, and 3 or 4 angels.
"A raiding party,"
said King Ogunwe. They were closing on the gyropters. Then a line of light blazed from one of the straight-winged aircraft, followed a second or two later by a sound, a deep crack. But the shell never reached its target, the crippled gyropter, because in the same instant as they saw the light, and before they heard the crack, the watchers on the mountain saw a flash from the intention craft, and a shell exploded in midair. Mrs. Coulter had hardly time to understand that almost instantaneous sequence of light and sound before the battle was underway. Nor was it at all easy to follow, because the sky was so dark and the movement of every flyer so quick. But a series of nearly silent flashes lit the mountainside, accompanied by short hisses like the escape of steam. Each flash struck somehow at a different radar. The aircraft caught fire or exploded. The giant bird uttered a scream like the tearing of a mountain-high curtain and plummeted onto the rocks far below. And as for the angels, each of them simply vanished in a drift of glowing air, a myriad particles twinkling and glowing dimmer until they flickered out like a dying firework. Then there was silence. The wind carried away the sound of the decoy gyropters, which had now disappeared around the flank of the mountain, and no one watching spoke. Flames far below glared on the underside of the intention craft, still somehow hovering in the air, and now turning slowly as if to look around. The destruction of the raiding party was so complete that Mrs. Coulter, who had seen many things to be shocked by, was nevertheless shocked by this. As she looked up at the intention craft, it seemed to shimmer or dislodge itself, and then there it was, solidly on the ground again. King Ogunwe hurried forward, as did the other commanders and the engineers, who had thrown open the doors and let the light flood out over the proving ground. Mrs. Coulter stayed where she was, puzzling over the workings of the intention craft.
"Why is he showing it to us?"
her demon said.
"Surely he can't have read our mind."
They were thinking of the moment in the adamant tower when that spark-like idea had flashed between them. They had thought of making Lord Asriel a proposition, of offering to go to the consistorial court of discipline and spy for him. She knew every lever of power. She could manipulate them all. It would be hard at first to convince them of her good faith, but she could do it. And now that the Gallivespian spies had left to go with Will and Lyra, surely Asriel couldn't resist an offer like that. But now, as they looked at that strange flying machine, another idea struck even more forcibly, and she hugged the golden monkey with glee.
"Asriel, may I see how the machine works?"
He looked down, his expression distracted and impatient, but full of excited satisfaction, too. He was delighted with the intention craft. She knew he wouldn't be able to resist showing it off. King Ogunwe stood aside, and Lord Asriel reached down and pulled her up into the cockpit. He helped her into the seat and watched as she looked around the controls.
"How does it work? What power is it?"
"Your intentions. Hence the name. If you intend to go forward, it will go forward."
"That's no answer. Come on, tell me. What sort of engine is it? How does it fly? I couldn't see anything aerodynamic at all. But these controls, from inside, it's almost like a gyropter."
He was finding it hard not to tell her. And since she was in his power, he did. He held out a cable at the end of which was a leather grip, deeply marked by his demon's teeth.
Your demon has to hold this handle. Whether in teeth or hands, it doesn't matter. And you have to wear that helmet. There's a current flowing between them, and a capacitor amplifies it. Well, it's more complicated than that, but the thing's simple to fly. We put in controls like a gyropter for the sake of familiarity, but eventually we won't need controls at all. Of course, only a human with a demon can fly it.
I see.
And she pushed him hard so that he fell out of the machine. In the same moment, she slipped the helmet on her head, and the golden monkey snatched up the leather handle. She reached for the control that in a gyropter would tilt the aerofoil and pushed the throttle forwards, and at once the intention craft leapt into the air. But she didn't quite have the measure of it yet. The craft hung still for some moments, slightly tilted, before she found the controls to move it forwards. And in those few seconds, Lord Asriel did three things. He leapt to his feet, he put up his hand to stop King Ogunwe from ordering the soldiers to fire on the intention craft, and he said,
Lord Roke, go with her, if you would be so kind.
The Gallivespian urged his blue hawk upwards at once, and the bird flew straight to the still-open cabin door. The watchers below could see the woman's head looking this way and that, and the golden monkey likewise, and they could see that neither of them noticed the little figure of Lord Roke leaping from his hawk into the cabin behind them. A moment later the intention craft began to move, and the hawk wheeled away to skim down to Lord Asriel's wrist. No more than 2 seconds later, the aircraft was already vanishing from sight in the damp and starry air. Lord Asriel watched with rueful admiration.
Well, King, you were quite right, and I should have listened to you in the first place. She is Lyra's mother. I might have expected something like that.
Aren't you going to pursue her?
What, and destroy a perfectly good aircraft? Certainly not.
Where do you think she'll go? In search of the child?
Not at first. She doesn't know where to find her. I know exactly what she'll do. She'll go to the consistorial court and give them the intention craft as an earnest pledge of good faith. And then she'll spy. She'll spy on them for us. She's tried every other kind of duplicity. That one'll be a novel experience. And as soon as she finds out where the girl is, she'll go there, and we shall follow.
And when will Lord Roke let her know he's come with her?
Oh, I think he'll keep that as a surprise, don't you?
They moved back into the workshops, where a later, more advanced model of the intention craft was awaiting their inspection. Chapter 17. Oil and Lacquer.
Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. The Book of Genesis.
Mary Malone was constructing a mirror, not out of vanity, for she had little of that, but because she wanted to test an idea she had. She wanted to try and catch shadows, and without the instruments in her laboratory she had to improvise with the materials at hand. Mulefa technology had little use for metal. They did extraordinary things with stone and wood and cord and shell and horn, but what metals they had were hammered from native nuggets of copper and other metals that they found in the sand of the river, and they were never used for tool-making. They were ornamental. Mulefa couples, for example, on entering marriage, would exchange strips of bright copper, which were bent around the base of one of their horns with much the same meaning as a wedding ring. So they were fascinated by the Swiss army knife that was Mary's most valuable possession. Atal, the Zalif who was her particular friend, exclaimed with astonishment one day when Mary unfolded the knife and showed her all the parts, and explained as well as she could, with her limited language, what they were for. One attachment was a miniature magnifying glass, with which she began to burn a design onto a dry branch, and it was that which set her thinking about shadows. They were fishing at the time, but the river was low and the fish must have been elsewhere, so they let the net lie across the water and sat on the grassy bank and talked, until Mary saw the dry branch which had a smooth white surface. She burned the design, a simple daisy, into the wood, and delighted Atal. But as the thin line of smoke wafted up from the spot where the focused sunlight touched the wood, Mary thought, if this became fossilized, and a scientist in 10 million years found it, they could still find shadows around it, because I've worked on it. She drifted into a sun-doped reverie until Atal asked,
What are you dreaming?
Mary tried to explain about her work, her research, the laboratory, the discovery of shadow particles, the fantastical revelation that they were conscious, and found the whole tale gripping her again, so that she longed to be back among her equipment. She didn't expect Atal to follow her explanation, partly because of her own imperfect command of their language, but partly because the Molefa seemed so practical, so strongly rooted in the physical everyday world, and much of what she was saying was mathematical. But Atal surprised her by saying,
"Yes, we know what you mean. We call it..."
And then she used a word that sounded like their word for light. Mary said,
"Light?"
Atal said,
"Not light, but..."
And said the word more slowly for Mary to catch.
"Like the light on water when it makes small ripples at sunset. And the light comes off in bright flakes. We call it that. But it is a make-like."
Make-like was their term for metaphor, Mary had discovered. So she said,
"It is not really light, but you see it, and it looks like that light on water at sunset."
Atal said,
"Yes. All the Molefa have this. You have too. That is how we knew you were like us, and not like the grazers who don't have it. Even though you look so bizarre and horrible, you are like us, because you have..."
And again came that word that Mary couldn't hear quite clearly enough to say, something like sraf or sarf, accompanied by a leftward flick of the trunk. Mary was excited. She had to keep herself calm enough to find the right words.
"What do you know about it? Where does it come from?"
"From us, and from the oil,"
was Atal's reply, and Mary knew she meant the oil in the great seed pod wheels.
"From you?"
"When we have grown up. But without the trees it would just vanish again. With the wheels and the oil, it stays among us."
"When you have grown up."
Again, Mary had to keep herself from becoming incoherent. One of the things she'd begun to suspect about shadows was that children and adults reacted to them differently, or attracted different kinds of shadow activity. Hadn't Lyra said that the scientists in her world had discovered something like that about dust, which was their name for shadows? Here it was again. And it was connected to what the shadows had said to her on the computer screen, just before she'd left her own world. Whatever it was, this question, it had to do with the great change in human history symbolized in the story of Adam and Eve, with the temptation, the fall, original sin. In his investigations among fossil skulls, her colleague, Oliver Payne, had discovered that around 30,000 years ago, a great increase had taken place in the number of shadow particles associated with human remains. Something had happened then, some development in evolution, to make the human brain an ideal channel for amplifying their effects. She said to Atal,
"How long have there been Molefa?"
And Atal said,
33,000 years.
She was able to read Mary's expressions by this time, or the most obvious of them at least, and she laughed at the way Mary's jaw dropped. The Molefa's laughter was free and joyful and so infectious that Mary usually had to join in, but now she remained serious and astounded and said,
"How can you know so exactly? Do you have a history of all those years?"
"Oh, yes. Ever since we have had the sraf, we have had memory and wakefulness. Before that, we remembered nothing."
"What happened to give you the sraf?"
"We discovered how to use the wheels. One day a creature with no name discovered a seed pod and began to play. And as she played, she had no name before then. She saw a snake coiling itself through the hole in a seed pod, and the snake said..."
"The snake spoke to her?"
"No, no. It is a make-like. The story tells that the snake said, 'What do you know? What do you remember? What do you see ahead?' And she said, 'Nothing, nothing, nothing.' So the snake said, 'Put your foot through the hole in the seed pod where I was playing, and you will become wise.' So she put a foot in where the snake had been, and the oil entered her blood and helped her see more clearly than before. And the first thing she saw was the sraf. It was so strange and pleasant that she wanted to share it at once with her kindred.
So she and her mate took the seed pods, and they discovered that they knew who they were. They knew they were Mulefa and not grazers. They gave each other names. They named themselves Mulefa. They named the seed tree and all the creatures and plants.
Because they were different?
Yes, they were. And so were their children. Because as more seed pods fell, they showed their children how to use them. And when the children were old enough to ride the wheels, they began to generate the Sraf as well. And the Sraf came back with the oil and stayed with them. So they saw that they had to plant more seed pod trees for the sake of the oil. But the pods were so hard that they seldom germinated. So the first Mulefa saw what they must do to help the trees, which was to ride on the wheels and break them. So Mulefa and seed pod trees have always lived together.
Mary directly understood about a quarter of what Atal was saying, but by questioning and guessing she found out the rest quite accurately, and her own command of the language was increasing all the time. The more she learned, though, the more difficult it became, as each new thing she found out suggested half a dozen questions, each leading in a different direction. But she pulled her mind after the subject of Sraf, because that was the biggest, and that was why she thought about the mirror. It was the comparison of Sraf to the sparkles on water that suggested it. Reflected light, like the glare off the sea, was polarized. It might be that the shadow particles, when they behaved like waves, as light did, were capable of being polarized too.
"I can't see Sraf as you can,"
Mary said.
"But I would like to make a mirror out of the sap lacquer, because I think that might help me see it."
Atal was excited by this idea, and they hauled in their net at once and began to gather what Mary needed. As a token of good luck, there were three fine fish in the net. The sap lacquer was a product of another and much smaller tree, which the Mulefa cultivated for that purpose. By boiling the sap and dissolving it in the alcohol they made from distilled fruit juice, the Mulefa made a substance like milk in consistency, and delicate amber in colour, which they used as a varnish. They would put up to 20 coats on a base of wood or shell, letting each one cure under wet cloth before applying the next, and gradually build up a surface of great hardness and brilliance. They would usually make it opaque with various oxides, but sometimes they left it transparent, and that was what had interested Mary, because the clear amber-coloured lacquer had the same curious property as the mineral known as Iceland spar. It split light rays in two, so that when you looked through it, you saw double. She wasn't sure what she wanted to do, except that she knew that if she fooled around for long enough, without fretting or nagging herself, she'd find out. She remembered quoting the words of the poet Keats to Lyra, and Lyra's understanding at once that that was her own state of mind when she read the Alethiometer. That was what Mary had to find now. So she began by finding herself a more or less flat piece of a wood like pine, and grinding at the surface with a piece of sandstone, no metal, no planes, until it was as flat as she could make it. That was the method the Mulefa used, and it worked well enough with time and effort. Then she visited the lacquer grove with Atal, having carefully explained what she was intending, and asked permission to take some sap. The Mulefa were happy to let her, but too busy to be concerned. With Atal's help, she drew off some of the sticky, resinous sap, and then came the long process of boiling, dissolving, boiling again, until the varnish was ready to use. The Mulefa used pads of a cottony fibre from another plant to apply it, and following the instructions of a craftsman, she laboriously painted her mirror over and over again, seeing hardly any difference each time as the layer of lacquer was so thin, but letting it cure unhurriedly and finding gradually that the thickness was building up. She painted on over 40 coats, she lost count, but by the time her lacquer had run out, the surface was at least 5 millimeters thick. After the final layer came the polishing, a whole day of rubbing the surface gently in smooth circular movements until her arms ached and her head was throbbing and she could bear the labour no more. Then she slept. Next morning the group went to work in a coppice of what they called knotwood, making sure the shoots were growing as they had been set, tightening the interweaving so that the grown sticks would be properly shaped. They valued Mary's help for this task, as she on her own could squeeze into narrower gaps than the Mulefa, and with her double hands work in tighter spaces. It was only when that work was done, and they had returned to the settlement, that Mary could begin to experiment, or rather to play, since she still didn't have a clear idea of what she was doing. First she tried using the lacquer sheet simply as a mirror, but for lack of a silvered back, all she could see was a doubled reflection faintly in the wood. Then she thought that what she really needed was the lacquer without the wood, but she quailed at the idea of making another sheet. How could she make it flat without a backing anyway? The idea came of simply cutting the wood away to leave the lacquer. That would take time too, but at least she had the Swiss Army knife. And she began, splitting it very delicately from the edge, taking the greatest of care not to scratch the lacquer from behind, but eventually removing most of the pine and leaving a mess of torn and splintered wood stuck immovably to the pane of clear, hard varnish. She wondered what would happen if she soaked it in water. Did the lacquer soften if it got wet?
No,
said her master in the craft.
It will remain hard forever. But why not do it like this?
And he showed her a liquid kept in a stone bowl, which would eat through any wood in only a few hours. It looked and smelled to Mary like an acid. That would hurt the lacquer hardly at all, he said, and she could repair any damage easily enough. He was intrigued by her project and helped her to swab the acid delicately onto the wood, telling her how they made it by grinding and dissolving and distilling a mineral they found at the edge of some shallow lakes she had not yet visited. Gradually the wood softened and came free, and Mary was left with a single sheet of clear brown-yellow lacquer, about the size of a page from a paperback book. She polished the reverse as highly as the top, until both were as flat and smooth as the finest mirror, and when she looked through it, nothing in particular. It was perfectly clear, but it showed her a double image, the right one quite close to the left and about 15 degrees upwards. She wondered what would happen if she looked through two pieces, one on top of the other. So she took the Swiss Army knife again and tried to score a line across the sheet so she could cut it in two. By working and reworking and by keeping the knife sharp on a smooth stone, she managed to score a line deep enough for her to risk snapping the sheet. She laid a thin stick under the score line and pushed sharply down on the lacquer, as she'd seen a glazier cutting glass, and it worked. Now she had two sheets. She put them together and looked through. The amber color was denser, and like a photographic filter it emphasized some colors and held back others, giving a slightly different cast to the landscape. The curious thing was that the doubleness had disappeared, and everything was single again, but there was no sign of shadows. She moved the two pieces apart, watching how the appearance of things changed as she did so. When they were about a hand span apart, a curious thing happened. The amber colouring disappeared, and everything seemed its normal colour, but brighter and more vivid. At that point, Atal came along to see what she was doing.
Can you see Sraf now?
No, but I can see other things,
Mary said, and tried to show her. Atal was interested, but politely, not with the sense of discovery that was animating Mary. And presently the Zalif tired of looking through the small pieces of lacquer and settled down on the grass to maintain her wheels and claws. Sometimes the Mulefa would groom each other's claws out of pure sociability, and once or twice Atal had invited Mary to attend to hers. Mary, in turn, let Atal tidy her hair, enjoying how the soft trunk lifted it and let it fall, stroking and massaging her scalp. She sensed that Atal wanted this now, so she put down the two pieces of lacquer and ran her hands over the astonishing smoothness of Atal's claws, that surface smoother and slicker than Teflon that rested on the lower rim of the central hole and served as a bearing when the wheel turned. The contours matched exactly, of course, and as Mary ran her hands around the inside of the wheel, she could feel no difference in texture. It was as if the Mulefa and the seed pod really were one creature, which by a miracle could disassemble itself and put itself together again. Atal was soothed, and so was Mary, by this contact. Her friend was young and unmarried, and there were no young males in this group, so she would have to marry a Zalif from outside. But contact wasn't easy, and sometimes Mary thought that Atal was anxious about her future. So she didn't begrudge the time she spent with her, and now she was happy to clean the wheel holes of all the dust and grime that accumulated there, and smooth the fragrant oil gently over her friend's claws while Atal's trunk lifted and straightened her hair. When Atal had had enough, she set herself on the wheels again and moved away to help with the evening meal. Mary turned back to her lacquer, and almost at once she made her discovery. She held the two plates a hand span apart so that they showed that clear, bright image she'd seen before. But something had happened. As she looked through, she saw a swarm of golden sparkle surrounding the form of Atal. They were only visible through one small part of the lacquer, and then Mary realized why. At that point, she had touched the surface of it with her oily fingers.
Atal! Quick! Come back!
Atal turned and wheeled back.
Let me take a little oil. Just enough to put on the lacquer.
Atal willingly let her run her fingers around the wheel holes again, and watched curiously as Mary coated one of the pieces with a film of the clear, sweet substance. Then she pressed the plates together and moved them around to spread the oil evenly, and held them a hand span apart once more. And when she looked through, everything was changed. She could see shadows. If she'd been in the Jordan College retiring room, when Lord Asriel had projected the photograms he'd made with the special emulsion, she would have recognized the effect. Everywhere she looked, she could see gold, just as Atal had described it. Sparkles of light, floating and drifting and sometimes moving in a current of purpose. Among it all was the world she could see with the naked eye, the grass, the river, the trees. But wherever she saw a conscious being, one of the Mulefa, the light was thicker and more full of movement. It didn't obscure their shapes in any way. If anything, it made them clearer.
I didn't know it was beautiful,
Mary said to Atal.
Why, of course it is,
her friend replied.
It is strange to think that you couldn't see it. Look at the little one.
Atal indicated one of the small children playing in the long grass, leaping clumsily after grasshoppers, suddenly stopping to examine a leaf, falling over, scrambling up again to rush and tell his mother something, being distracted again by a piece of stick, trying to pick it up, finding ants on his trunk and hooting with agitation. There was a golden haze around him, as there was around the shelters, the fishing nets, the evening fire, stronger than theirs, though not by much. But unlike theirs, it was full of little swirling currents of intention that eddied and broke off and drifted about, to disappear as new ones were born. Around his mother, on the other hand, the golden sparkles were much stronger, and the currents they moved in were more settled and powerful. She was preparing food, spreading flour on a flat stone, making the thin bread like chapatis or tortillas, watching her child at the same time. And the shadows, or the sraf, or the dust, that bathed her, looked like the very image of responsibility and wise care.
So at last you can see. Well, now you must come with me.
Mary looked at her friend in puzzlement. Atal's tone was strange. It was as if she were saying, finally you're ready. We've been waiting. Now things must change. And others were appearing, from over the brow of the hill, from out of their shelters, from along the river. Members of the group, but strangers too, Mulefa who were new to her, and who looked curiously towards where she was standing. The sound of their wheels on the hard-packed earth was low and steady.
Where must I go?
Mary said.
Why are they all coming here?
Don't worry,
said Atal.
Come with me. We shall not hurt you.
It seemed to have been long planned, this meeting, for they all knew where to go and what to expect. There was a low mound at the edge of the village that was regular in shape and packed with hard earth, with ramps at each end, and the crowd, 50 or so at least, Mary estimated, was moving towards it. The smoke of the cooking fires hung in the evening air, and the setting sun spread its own kind of hazy gold over everything. Mary was aware of the smell of roasting corn and the warm smell of the Mulefa themselves, part oil, part warm flesh, a sweet, horse-like smell. Atal urged her towards the mound. Mary said,
What is happening? Tell me.
No, no, not me. Satamax will speak.
Mary didn't know the name Satamax, and the Zalif whom Atal indicated was a stranger to her. He was older than anyone she'd seen so far. At the base of his trunk was a scatter of white hairs, and he moved stiffly as if he had arthritis. The others all moved with care around him, and when Mary stole a glance through the lacquer glass, she saw why. The old Zalif's shadow cloud was so rich and complex that Mary herself felt respect, even though she knew so little of what it meant. When Satamax was ready to speak, the rest of the crowd fell silent. Mary stood close to the mound, with Atal nearby for reassurance. But she sensed all their eyes on her and felt as if she were a new girl at school. Satamax began to speak. His voice was deep, the tones rich and varied, the gestures of his trunk low and graceful.
"We have all come together to greet the stranger, Mary. Those of us who know her have reason to be grateful for her activities since she arrived among us. We have waited until she had some command of our language. With the help of many of us, but especially the Zalif Atal, the stranger Mary can now understand us. But there was another thing she had to understand, and that was Shraf. She knew about it, but she could not see it as we can until she made an instrument to look through. And now she has succeeded. She is ready to learn more about what she must do to help us. Mary, come here and join me."
Mary felt dizzy, self-conscious, bemused, but she did as she had to and stepped up beside the old Zalif. She thought she had better speak, so she began.
"You have all made me feel I am a friend. You are kind and hospitable. I came from a world where life is very different, but some of us are aware of Sraf, as you are, and I'm grateful for your help in making this glass through which I can see it. If there is any way in which I can help you, I will be glad to do it."
She spoke more awkwardly than she did with Atal, and she was afraid she hadn't made her meaning clear. It was hard to know where to face when you had to gesture as well as speak, but they seemed to understand. Satamax said,
"It is good to hear you speak. We hope you will be able to help us. If not, I cannot see how we will survive. The Tualapi will kill us all. There are more of them than there ever were, and their numbers are increasing every year. Something has gone wrong with the world. For most of the 33,000 years that there have been Mulefa, we have taken care of the earth. Everything balanced. The trees prospered, the grazers were healthy, and even if once in a while the Tualapi came, our numbers and theirs remained constant. But 300 years ago, the trees began to sicken. We watched them anxiously, and tended them with care, and still we found them producing fewer seed pods, and dropping their leaves out of season, and some of them died outright, which had never been known. All our memory could not find a cause for this. To be sure, the process was slow, but so is the rhythm of our lives. We did not know that until you came. We have seen butterflies and birds, but they have no Sraf. You do, strange as you seem. But you are swift and immediate, like birds, like butterflies. You realize there is a need for something to help you see Sraf. And instantly, out of the materials we have known for thousands of years, you put together an instrument to do so. Beside us, you think and act with the speed of a bird. That is how it seems, which is how we know that our rhythm seems slow to you. But that fact is our hope. You can see things that we cannot. You can see connections and possibilities and alternatives that are invisible to us, just as Sraf was invisible to you. And while we cannot see a way to survive, we hope that you may. We hope that you will go swiftly to the cause of the tree's sickness and find a cure. We hope you will invent a means of dealing with the Tualapi, who are so numerous and so powerful. And we hope you can do so soon, or we shall all die.
There was a murmur of agreement and approval from the crowd. They were all looking at Mary, and she felt more than ever like the new pupil at a school where they had high expectations of her. She also felt a strange flattery. The idea of herself as swift and darting and bird-like was new and pleasant, because she had always thought of herself as dogged and plodding. But along with that came the feeling that they'd got it terribly wrong if they saw her like that. They didn't understand at all. She couldn't possibly fulfill this desperate hope of theirs. But equally, she must. They were waiting.
Satamax, Mulefa, you put your trust in me, and I shall do my best. You have been kind, and your life is good and beautiful, and I will try very hard to help you. And now I have seen Sraf, I know what it is that I'm doing. Thank you for trusting me.
They nodded and murmured and stroked her with their trunks as she stepped down. She was daunted by what she had agreed to do. At that very moment in the world of Chitagatse, the assassin priest Father Gomez was making his way up a rough track in the mountains between the twisted trunks of olive trees. The evening light slanted through the silvery leaves, and the air was full of the noise of crickets and cicadas. Ahead of him he could see a little farmhouse sheltered among vines, where a goat bleated and a spring trickled down through the grey rocks. There was an old man attending to some task beside the house, and an old woman leading the goat towards a stool and a bucket. In the village some way behind, they had told him that the woman he was following had passed this way, and that she talked of going up into the mountains. Perhaps this old couple had seen her. At least there might be cheese and olives to buy and spring water to drink. Father Gomez was quite used to living frugally, and there was plenty of time. Chapter 18. The Suburbs of the Dead.
Oh, that it were possible we might but hold some 2 days' conference with the dead. John Webster.
Lyra was awake before dawn, with Pantalaimon shivering at her breast, and she got up to walk about and warm herself up as the grey light seeped into the sky. She had never known such silence, not even in the snow-blanketed Arctic. There was not a stir of wind, and the sea was so still that not the tiniest ripple broke on the sand. The world seemed suspended between breathing in and breathing out. Will lay curled up fast asleep, with his head on the rucksack to protect the knife. The cloak had fallen off his shoulder, and she tucked it around him, pretending that she was taking care to avoid his demon, and that she had the form of a cat curled up just as he was. She must be here somewhere, Lyra thought. Carrying the still sleepy Pantalaimon, she walked away from Will and sat down on the slope of a sand dune a little way off, so their voices wouldn't wake him.
"Those little people,"
Pantalaimon said.
"I don't like them. I think we should get away from them as soon as we can. I reckon if we trap them in a net or something, Will can cut through and close up, and that's it. We'll be free."
"We haven't got a net or something. Anyway, I bet they're cleverer than that. He's watching us now."
Pantalaimon was a hawk as he said that, and his eyes were keener than hers. The darkness of the sky was turning minute by minute into the palest ethereal blue, and as she looked across the sand, the first edge of the sun just cleared the rim of the sea, dazzling her. Because she was on the slope of the dune, the light reached her a few seconds before it touched the beach, and she watched it flow around her and along towards Will. And then she saw the hand-high figure of the Chevalier Tialis, standing by Will's head, clear and wide awake, and watching them.
"The thing is, they can't make us do what they want. They got to follow us. I bet they're fed up."
if they got hold of us,
said Pantalaimon, meaning him and Lyra,
and got their stings ready to stick in us, Willard have to do what they said.
Lyra thought about it. She remembered vividly the horrible scream of pain from Mrs. Coulter, the eye-rolling convulsions, the ghastly lolling drool of the golden monkey as the poison entered her bloodstream. And that was only a scratch, as her mother had recently been reminded elsewhere. Will would have to give in and do what they wanted.
Suppose they thought he wouldn't, though. Suppose they thought he was so cold-hearted he'd just watch us die. Maybe he better make them think that, if he can.
She had brought the alethiometer with her, and now that it was light enough to see, she took the beloved instrument out and laid it on its black velvet cloth in her lap. Little by little, Lyra drifted into that trance in which the many layers of meaning were clear to her, and where she could sense intricate webs of connectedness between them all. As her fingers found the symbols, her mind found the words, "How can we get rid of the spies?" Then the needle began to dart this way and that, almost too fast to see, and some part of Lyra's awareness counted the swings and the stops and saw at once the meaning of what the movement said. It told her, "Do not try, because your lives depend on them." That was a surprise and not a happy one. But she went on and asked, "How can we get to the land of the dead?" The answer came, "Go down. Follow the knife. Go onwards. Follow the knife." And finally she asked hesitantly, half ashamed, "Is this the right thing to do?" "Yes," said the alethiometer instantly. "Yes." She sighed, coming out of her trance, and tucked the hair behind her ears, feeling the first warmth of the sun on her face and shoulders. There were sounds in the world now, too. Insects were stirring, and a very slight breeze was rustling the dry grass stems growing higher up the dune. She put the alethiometer away and wandered back to Will, with Pantalaimon as large as he could make himself, and lion-shaped, in the hope of daunting the Gallivespians. The man was using his lodestone apparatus, and when he'd finished, Lyra said,
"You been talking to Lord Asriel?"
"To his representative,"
said Tialis.
"We ain't going."
"That's what I told him."
"What did he say?"
"That was for my ears, not yours."
"Suit yourself. Are you married to that lady?"
"No. We are colleagues."
"Have you got any children?"
"No."
Tialis continued to pack the lodestone resonator away, and as he did so, the Lady Salmakia woke up nearby, sitting up graceful and slow from the little hollow she'd made in the soft sand. The dragonflies were still asleep, tethered with cobweb-thin cord, their wings damp with dew.
"Are there big people on your world, or are they all small like you?"
"We know how to deal with big people,"
Tialis replied, not very helpfully, and went to talk quietly to the lady. They spoke too softly for Lyra to hear, but she enjoyed watching them sip dewdrops from the marum grass to refresh themselves. Water must be different for them, she thought to Pantalaimon. Imagine drops the size of your fist. They'd be hard to get into. They'd have a sort of elastic rind, like a balloon. By this time, Will was waking too, wearily. The first thing he did was to look for the Gallivespians, who looked back at once, fully focused on him. He looked away and found Lyra.
"I want to tell you something,"
she said.
"Come over here, away from..."
"If you go away from us, you must leave the knife. If you won't leave the knife, you must talk to each other here."
"Can't we be private? We don't want you listening to what we say."
"Then go away, but leave the knife."
There was no one else nearby, after all, and certainly the Gallivespians wouldn't be able to use it. Will rummaged in the rucksack for the water bottle and a couple of biscuits, and handing one to Lyra, he went with her up the slope of the dune.
"I asked the alethiometer, and it said we shouldn't try and escape from the little people, because they were going to save our lives. So maybe we're stuck with them."
"Have you told them what we're going to do?"
"No, and I won't either, because they'll only tell Lord Asriel on that speaking fiddle, and he'd go there and stop us. So we got to just go, and not talk about it in front of them."
"They are spies, though. They must be good at listening and hiding. So maybe we better not mention it at all. We know where we're going, so we'll just go and not talk about it. And they'll have to put up with it and come along."
"They can't hear us now. They're too far off. Will, I asked how we'd get there too. It said to follow the knife. Just that."
"Sounds easy, but I bet it isn't. Do you know what Yorick told me?"
No. He said, when I went to say goodbye, he said it would be very difficult for you. But he thought you could do it. But he never told me why.
The knife broke because I thought of my mother. So, I've got to put her out of my mind. But it's like when someone says, don't think about a crocodile. You do. You can't help it.
Well, you cut through last night, all right.
Yeah, because I was tired, I think. Well, we'll see. Just follow the knife.
That's all it said.
Might as well go now, then. Except there's not much food left. We ought to find something to take with us. Bread and fruit or something. So first I'll find a world where we can get food, and then we'll start looking properly.
All right,
said Lyra, quite happy to be moving again, with Pan and Will alive and awake. They made their way back to the spies, who were sitting alertly by the knife, packs on their backs.
We should like to know what you intend,
said Selmakia.
Well, we're not coming to Lord Asriel anyway,
said Will.
We've got something else to do first.
And will you tell us what that is, since it's clear we can't stop you from doing it?
No, because you just go and tell them. You'll have to come along without knowing where we're going. Of course, you could always give up and go back to them.
Certainly not,
said Tialis.
We want some kind of guarantee. You're spies, so you're bound to be dishonest. That's your trade. We need to know we can trust you. Last night we were all too tired and we couldn't think about it. But there'd be nothing to stop you waiting till we were asleep and then stinging us to make us helpless and calling up Lord Asriel on that lodestone thing. You could do that easily. So we need to have a proper guarantee that you won't. A promise isn't enough.
The two Gallivespians trembled with anger at this slur on their honour. Tialis, controlling himself, said,
We don't accept one-sided demands. You must give something in exchange. You must tell us what your intentions are. And then I shall give the lodestone resonator into your care. You must let me have it when I want to send a message, but you will always know when that happens, and we shall not be able to use it without your agreement. That will be our guarantee. And now you tell us where you are going and why.
Will and Lyra exchanged a glance to confirm it.
All right, that's fair. So here's where we're going. We're going to the world of the dead. We don't know where it is, but the knife will find it. That's what we're going to do.
The two spies were looking at her with open-mouthed incredulity. Then Selmakia blinked and said,
What you say doesn't make sense. The dead are dead, that's all. There is no world of the dead.
I thought that was true as well, but now I'm not sure. At least with the knife we can find out.
But why?
Lyra looked at Will and saw him nod.
Well, before I met Will, long before I was asleep, I led this friend into danger, and he was killed. I thought I was rescuing him, only I was making things worse. And while I was asleep, I dreamed of him. And I thought maybe I could make amends if I went where he's gone and said I was sorry. And Will wants to find his father, who died just when he found him before. See, Lord Asriel wouldn't think of that. Nor would Mrs. Coulter. If we went to him, we'd have to do what he wants. And he wouldn't think of Roger at all. That's my friend who died. It wouldn't matter to him. But it matters to me. To us. So that's what we want to do.
Child, when we die, everything is over. There is no other life. You have seen death. You've seen dead bodies. And you've seen what happens to a demon when death comes. It vanishes. What else can there be to live on after that?
We're going to go and find out. And now we've told you, I'll take your resonator lodestone.
She held out her hand, and Leopard Pantalaimon stood, tail swinging slowly, to reinforce her demand. Tialis unslung the pack from his back and laid it in her palm. It was surprisingly heavy, no burden for her, of course, but she marvelled at his strength.
And how long do you think this expedition will take?
Said the Chevalier.
We don't know. We don't know anything about it, any more than you do. We'll just go there and see.
First thing, we've got to get some water, and some more food, something easy to carry. So I'm going to find a world where we can do that, and then we'll set off.
Tialis and Selmakia mounted their dragonflies and held them quivering on the ground. The great insects were eager for flight, but the command of their riders was absolute, and Lyra, watching them in daylight for the first time, saw the extraordinary fineness of the grey silk reins, the silvery stirrups, the tiny saddles. Will took the knife, and a powerful temptation made him feel for the touch of his own world. He had the credit card still. He could buy familiar food. He could even telephone Mrs. Cooper and ask for news of his mother. The knife jarred with a sound like a nail being drawn along rough stone, and his heart nearly stopped. If he broke the blade again, it would be the end. After a few moments, he tried again. Instead of trying not to think of his mother, he said to himself, "Yes, I know she's there, but I'm just going to look away while I do this." And that time it worked. He found a new world and slid the knife along to make an opening, and a few moments later all of them were standing in what looked like a neat and prosperous farmyard in some northern country like Holland or Denmark, where the stone-flagged yard was swept and clean and a row of stable doors stood open. The sun shone down through a hazy sky, and there was the smell of burning in the air, as well as something less pleasant. There was no sound of human life, though a loud buzzing, so active and vigorous that it sounded like a machine, came from the stables. Lyra went and looked, and came back at once, looking pale.
"There's four..."
She gulped, hand to her throat, and recovered.
"Four dead horses in there, and millions of flies."
"Look, or maybe better not."
He was pointing at the raspberry canes that edged the kitchen garden. He'd just seen a man's legs, one with a shoe on and one without, protruding from the thickest part of the bushes. Lyra didn't want to look, but Will went to see if the man was still alive and needed help. He came back, shaking his head, looking uneasy. The two spies were already at the farmhouse door, which was ajar. Dialis darted back and said,
"It smells sweeter in there."
And then he flew back over the threshold while Salmakia scouted further around the outbuildings. Will followed the Chevalier. He found himself in a big square kitchen, an old-fashioned place with white china on a wooden dresser and a scrubbed pine table and a hearth where a black kettle stood cold. Next door there was a pantry with two shelves full of apples that filled the whole room with fragrance. The silence was oppressive.
"Will, is this the world of the dead?"
The same thought had occurred to him, but he said,
"No, I don't think so. It's one we haven't been in before. Look, we'll load up with as much as we can carry. There's sort of rye bread. That'll be good, it's light. And here's some cheese."
When they had taken what they could carry, Will dropped a gold coin into the drawer in the big pine table.
"Well,"
said Lyra, seeing Tialis raise his eyebrows,
"you should always pay for what you take."
At that moment, Salmakia came in through the back door, landing her dragonfly on the table in a shimmer of electric blue.
"There are men coming, on foot with weapons. They're only a few minutes' walk away, and there is a village burning beyond the fields."
And as she spoke, they could hear the sound of boots on gravel, and a voice issuing orders, and the jingle of metal.
"Then we should go,"
said Will. He felt in the air with the knife point, and at once he was aware of a new kind of sensation. The blade seemed to be sliding along a very smooth surface like a mirror, and then it sank through slowly until he was able to cut. But it was resistant, like heavy cloth, and when he made an opening he blinked with surprise and alarm, because the world he was opening into was the same in every detail as the one they were already standing in.
"What's happening?"
said Lyra. The spies were looking through, puzzled, but it was more than puzzlement they felt. Just as the air had resisted the knife, so something in this opening resisted their going through. Will had to push against something invisible, and then pull Lyra after him, and the Gallivespians could hardly make any headway at all. They had to perch the dragonflies on the children's hands, and even then it was like pulling them against a pressure in the air. Their filmy wings bent and twisted, and the little riders had to stroke their mounts' heads and whisper to calm their fears. But after a few seconds of struggle, they were all through, and Will found the edge of the window, though it was impossible to see, and closed it, shutting the sound of the soldiers away in their own world.
"Will,"
said Lyra, and he turned to see that there was another figure in the kitchen with them. His heart jolted. It was the man he'd seen not 10 minutes before, stark dead in the bushes with his throat cut. He was middle-aged, lean, with the look of a man who spent most of the time in the open air. But now he was looking almost crazed or paralyzed with shock. His eyes were so wide that the white showed all around the iris, and he was clutching the edge of the table with a trembling hand. His throat, Will was glad to see, was intact. He opened his mouth to speak, but no words came out. All he could do was point at Will and laugh.